from WOUB News, you're listening to The Outlet, where campus meets community. I'm Caleb McCleskey. Each week on The Outlet, we bring you stories from Southeast Ohio. This week on The Outlet, a special report about our environment and sustainability. Local organizations emphasize the importance of recycling and what happens to those materials when they leave your home.
Has allowed this region's recycling to just grow exponentially. So people are much more likely to recycle if it's just two bins, trash recycling, right? So mixed recycling, and if it can be curbsides.
And Athens Emergency Services create new tactics to deal with emergencies. These stories and more right here on The Outlet. Do you ever wonder what happens after you toss your recyclables in the bin? Outlet reporter Domin Varney has more on the recycling process in Athens and what you could do to make it more efficient.
The city of Athens is known for being environmentally friendly. Back in 1984, it became the first city in Ohio to establish a curbside recycling program, and since then, they've emerged as a leader in the state. Thanks to the Athens Hocking Recycling Center, a nonprofit organization, Athens Recycling has a 10% contamination rate. This is well below the national average of 20%. That means only 10% of the materials that Athens recycles is diverted back to the landfills. Krissa Cummings, the executive director and human resources manager at the materials recovery facility, notes that the facility puts recycling in the Athens Hocking area above others.
It has allowed this region's recycling to just grow exponentially. So people are much more likely to recycle if it's just two bins, trash recycling, right? So mixed recycling, and if it can be curbsides.
The Athens Materials Recovery Facility was built in 2016 and is crucial to the overall recycling process. At the facility, once the materials are dropped off by the recycling trucks, they are sorted and distributed. Through a combination of both machines and workers, the materials are separated into their respective categories: glass, steel, aluminum, paper, cardboard, and plastic, to name a few. The glass, steel, and aluminum are never touched by workers. These are all separated by an assortment of magnets and machines, while the paper and plastic are sorted via assembly line. Once the materials are all sorted and deemed contaminant-free, they're baled with a hydraulic press, packing everything into a giant compact cube. Each of these bales are then loaded onto a truck full of their respective materials and sold and shipped off to different buyers. According to Cummings, the most popular product made from recyclable materials is cardboard.
They are processed into primarily more paper, more cardboard boxes to fuel all of our Amazon and online ordering. So most of your cardboard and paper end up as more paper boxes for shipping.
In order to keep having boxes and bags for all of your online shopping needs, people need to recycle. Many might wonder just how their impact can make a difference. Cummings assures locals that it's worth their time, especially when an entire community lends a hand.
An individual person's recycling isn't going to fill a semi, but when everybody in the region actually does the recycling, it results in millions of pounds of recycling collectively that we're diverting from the landfill.
Not only will recycling divert tons of materials from the landfill, but clean recyclables will make an even bigger impact. Cleaning materials before you recycle them is crucial in keeping contamination rates down. Ohio transfer student Estella Giamini says Athens is one of the cleanest campuses she's ever been on and knows how important recycling clean materials is to the prevention of contaminants.
I think it can be super damaging just because if you do contaminate recycling bins, that means the entire recycling bin is no good.
According to Cummings, an entire bin being no good would result in the materials being sent back to landfills and having negative environmental effects. In a February 28th press release, AHRC reported that they are processing an average of 25 tons of recyclable materials a day. This contribution helps to keep the tons of materials discarded out of the landfills so they can be made into repurposed goods. Reporting for The Outlet, I'm Donovan Varney in Athens.
Ecological grief is a fairly new term, used to describe the grief farmers feel towards changing ecosystems and environments. The Outlet's Haley Hollinger speaks to locals about how ecological grief impacts their lives.
Dean and Karen Dennis own a farm in Sugar Grove, Ohio. Dean does the field work and Karen does the bookkeeping. And to them, eco grief's just the latest term describing the life of a farmer.
You never know what kind of a year you're going to have when that crop goes in the ground. You are at the mercy of Mother Nature. One bad year can set you back 5, maybe 6 years. And the economical grief of that is enormous. And it's a worry every year when those planters go in the ground until the combine takes it off in the fall.
We do have that problem, but we keep right on going. If we have a bad year, we try to keep going the next year to try to get back what we had. And it is
a worry.
Farming will always be challenging with worries like, will the equipment work properly? Is there enough money for repairs if it doesn't? And of course, will the crops provide enough revenue?
Emotionally, for me, getting up every morning and looking out and seeing the ground crack from the dryness and the corn and the beans starting to turn brown on the bottom, they stop growing. You can literally get up in the mornings and look out and see your crops dying in the field.
In, you know, the year 2012, we had been at one place that was doing pretty good, and I had my brother here, and we had 3 trucks semi sitting in the field, and 2 hours later, I think I had 1 or 2 dumps out of the combine in the truck, and that's pretty heartbreaking.
But people like Karen and Dean have learned to keep their heads up and keep on pushing through the rough times, no matter what.
Yes, there's stories that you could say and different things, but you just, sicker dogs than this have been healed, and you go on.
And
that's just the way you look at
it. You have to stop. You have to stop, and you say, okay, this has happened. Now we need to deal with it, and we'll figure it out. We always do.
And they say it takes resilience, but there's nothing else they would rather be doing.
Oh, it's hard to say I wouldn't change anything in what I've done, but I've enjoyed what I've done. We have it in our blood to go out and sit in the tractor for anywhere from 8 hours, and if it don't rain, you might be out there 16 or 24. And you have to want to do it.
Reporting for The Outlet, I'm Haley Hollinger.
Athens County Emergency Services figure out new ways to deal with region-wide emergency scenarios. Outlet reporter Parker Kopronica speaks with emergency officials about how they plan for the future.
We have emergency operation plans in place, but due to where the emergency is, we can't predict where we're going to evacuate or the route of evacuation.
Teresa Immler, director of the Athens County Emergency Management Agency, says trains carrying hazardous materials move in and out of the county every other day, meaning an accident similar to the toxic derailment in East Palestine is possible. In an effort to prepare, the EMA held derailment training in the village of Jacksonville last September.
We had a train that was leaking a chemical, and we literally set it up like an actual response. We had fire departments responding. We had the railroad there. We had Ohio EMA.
It's trainings like this, Immler says, that help first responders before even getting to the scene.
Athens County 911, when that call comes in to them, they have a set of standard operating guidelines that they have to follow. So if they enter train derailment into their CAD system, it'll tell them exactly who they need to notify.
But as a small EMA office, in a big emergency, the county can only do so much.
You have this mass emergency. Not one small county in southeastern Ohio could handle in East Palestine. We would have to count on our neighboring counties for our support, whether it be Perry, Vinton, Jackson.
As for the railroad companies, Christopher Spielmaker, senior communications manager for Norfolk Southern, says the company is working to help prepare first responders. He says the company has, quote, increased access to training for first responders, providing training to more than 5,000 first responders in 2023, and adding additional stops to our safety train schedule. Spielmaker says for tracks operated by Norfolk Southern, the company has, quote, launched a next-generation digital inspection portal to add an additional layer to train inspections, and are on track to complete the goal of shortening distances between hot hearing detectors on our court network to approximately 11 miles apart by the end of the year. As for what you can do to prepare in the case of a derailment like what happened in East Palestine, or for any disaster, Immler says it's always important to have a plan.
They should have a means of communication on how to contact their family member. They should have resources, supplies. They should have a plan on what they need to do if there is an evacuation order. You don't want family members searching for family members.
Reporting for The Outlet, I'm Parker Kopronica.
The U.S. Global Change Research Program has a fifth national climate assessment looking at climate change over recent years. One of the contributing authors is Jeffrey DeBelko, a professor at Ohio University's Voinovich School. Outlet reporter Silva Barker speaks to DeBelko about climate change here in the Midwest in the Appalachian region.
So Jeffrey, you were a part of the fifth National Climate Assessment, and more specifically, you were the co-author on the international chapter for the assessment. Well, bringing it now to, I guess, a local standpoint, how would you say climate change is affecting us here in the Appalachian area?
So I think it's interesting that generally we're seen as being less affected by the direct impacts of climate change than other parts of the country, right? We're not on a coast with sea level rise. We're not in line with some of the most extreme hurricanes. We're not in high forest fire areas. Yet, we see change happening here that will really matter for Ohioans. Change in the variability and the timing of precipitation, of rainfall. That matters if you're a farmer. That matters if you're trying to get to a really important appointment, but your roads are flooded out here, particularly in Appalachia, where that's a kind of historically has been a problem. And it's sneaky because it may not even be a different amount of rainfall over the course of a year. But if that comes in 5 storms instead of 25 storms, then that means an awful lot for the farmers. And it means an awful lot for those responsible for managing wastewater disposal and storm drains and dealing with flooding. And so we're going to have higher nighttime temperatures. So the challenges of heat, particularly for older adults and other kind of health vulnerable groups, that nighttime is when your body can cool down. And if your body can't cool down, then you face increased threats from dehydration and other heat related stresses on the body. What happens internationally or far from here can still affect us. We had in Ohio and Columbus in particular, had some of the worst air quality this past year due to the wildfires in Canada. And so what that burden on health and the kind of respiratory challenges, people with asthma, and again, older adults, that's a real direct health threat that is different than what we are used to, but unfortunately under what we anticipate with climate change is going to increasingly be a challenge that we are going to face here in Ohio, even if the fires are literally thousands of miles away.
I guess there's nothing that people can do to stop weather from being weather, I guess. You can't change the weather. But, I mean, is there anything people can do to lessen the number of challenges and problems we face with climate change?
People can be engaged on multiple levels. On its most foundational level, it's understanding that no one person or even one country is going to solve these challenges by themselves. Yet, if we don't try to change our behavior, then the conditions are going to get much, much worse for everyone. And so part of doing that is, in some respects, a mindset change, right? It's redefining the good life so it's not kind of happiness or success defined by how much you consume, but instead being rich in experiences and such that aren't contributing the greenhouse gases that are making climate change worse. Not consuming the plastic that both has a greenhouse gas impact in its production, but is also getting into our food supply and our ecosystems in ways that are changing our bodies and posing health threats, right? Mm-hmm. So consuming less as a kind of redefinition of what is success and what's a good life is kind of a both philosophical but also practical approach to how we proceed. And then being actively engaged in finding, small scale wins in your community where you can make a difference, right? And doing that is about changing, thinking about the, say, carbon footprint of your diet, right? Reducing the amount of animal-based protein will reduce emissions and also reduce water usage and pressure on the land, right? Changing how you move around, your transportation choices. Now, that's difficult in rural Appalachia where we don't have lots of options in terms of public access to transportation. But it really is, again, kind of purposefully thinking about how can I find ways in the different needs for moving around that I can make lower emissions and lower impact decisions. And so it's in these ways that things that we literally do every day, we eat and we move around, that we and how we heat our houses, right? And the kind of energy choices in infrastructure and transportation and in diet are all ways that we can make very meaningful changes. It'll be small in kind of a single sense, but adds up to our power from a marketplace, and kind of as consumers, we can engender larger changes from companies and industries that respond to our demands. So there are lots of ways we can make a difference, especially if we give ourselves permission not to have to solve the whole problem ourselves.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jeffrey, for being here with us today and talking a little bit about climate change. For those of you interested in learning more about the 5th National Climate Assessment, you can visit the website globalchange.gov.
Dylan Richardson, a reporter for WOUB Public Media, recently reported on the Tenderfoot Learning Lab and its sustainable methods it teaches local residents.
The Tenderfoot Learning Lab started in 2011 as a dream. Lindsay was working odds and ends jobs, and she noticed that a large amount of college students were struggling with, you know, cooking or gardening or doing things themselves outside in order to create sustainability in their lives. So Lindsay and Travis, the co-founders, took it upon themselves to try to create something and incorporate leadership with them that can help instill sustainable methods into the Athens area.
And then while you were at the lab, what were some of the sustainable methods that they talked about with you?
So some of the sustainable methods offered include food dehydration to preserve food longer. Another method that they teach is utilization of campfires, whether that's for cooking or whether that's for warmth. They also utilize knot tying. I know that's kind of a unique sustainable method, but in different scenarios, I think that that could be a really beneficial skill to have. Another sustainable method that they try to instill is, you know, building with your own hands. So if you have a skill that you would like to develop, then they would like to help you develop that skill. So Travis and Lindsay like to make a point that there are many skills offered at the Tenderfoot Learning Lab, and it is more so up to the attendee to focus or harness in on what skill they want to develop, and Travis and Lindsay will help you do that to the best of their abilities.
And then speaking more about these methods and how Travis and Lindsay really want college students to nail these down, would you also say that they also want a variety of individuals, regardless of age, to kind of show up there and get those methods as well?
Absolutely, Caleb. I think that they encourage, you know, as young as, you know, you're able to go. I think that, you know, the younger that you learn these sustainable methods, I think the better off overall. These are valuable skills that can be transferred across generations. So Generation X, Millennials, Generation Z, the next generation, you know, all of these generations can have key takeaways from participating with the Tenderfoot Learning Lab.
Reese Thompson, a reporter for WOUB Public Media, recently followed the process of trash disposal in Athens County. Turns out, there may be several steps of the process people may not be aware of once their trash is left curbside.
Recently, Rumke became the trash collector and owner of Athens Hocking Landfill, and they use a system of liners that prevent waste and wastewater from entering the soil. This creates layers between the trash and the soil itself, so it doesn't eventually become contaminated. Then the trash is compressed. This also helps conserve valuable airspace and more room for future trash that is added over time. And by decomposing organic material within the trash, that actually creates a toxic gas that is released into the air, and it's called methane.
And methane is a powerful greenhouse gas. What does that propose to the environment once it's released?
Anything that goes into the landfill is going to generate methane. And over 13,000 tons of trash go into the Athens Hawking landfill each year. That's according to the Athens Sustainability Action Plan current data. So you can imagine how much toxic gas like methane is accumulated from this. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas, meaning it affects climate change by contributing to global warming, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
And has the city of Athens made any efforts to address the toxins for the sake of the environment?
Yes, they are doing many things. Athens has always been really passionate about sustainability and protecting the environment, as you know. I talked to Jane Forrest Redfern with the Athens Hawking Solid Waste District, and she told me they plan on using disposable fees collected from the city to address those environmental problems. They plan to host recycling events where people can drop off things such as tires or other materials that many people have laying around their house. They also plan on hosting educational lessons for community members, to minimize waste generation.
Athens County and local cities could see changes to their trash and recycling services, putting these services back under government control. The Outlet's Jack Green has the latest on the Council of Governments.
So last night, Caleb, Service Safety Director Andy Stone and Mayor Patterson provided an update to the City Council about the discussions going on about the Council of Governments. It would bring solid, like you said, it would bring solid waste back under government control, making it now a government entity. These kind of discussions really started after Athens took its contract with Rumpke Waste and Recycling back in November. The city's old provider, which was Athens Hawking Recycling Centers, took a major blow to that decision. Athens was about 40% of their total income. So without Athens, they lost 40% of their income. And that's a very hefty amount, especially for a nonprofit. And so since then, Athens Hawking Recycling Centers has really kind of been trying to get this Council of Governments going because it would absorb the nonprofit and absorb its assets, making sure that the people that work at AHRC, their jobs are still there, and also keeping recycling, trash, and composting services here locally. So far, two groups have agreed to join. The Village of Amesville has passed a resolution saying that they are willing to join, and the Solid Waste District has said that they are in. Logan is another potential member of the COG. And so far, Logan has said it only wants it's the COG's recycling services. This is what's interesting about the COG is that Amesville and Logan are not in a franchise district. Now, what's a franchise district? It's basically the city deciding for you what your trash service is, who your trash provider is. So in Athens, we have Rumpke. If you live in the franchise district, you have to use Rumpke. It's the city's provider. If you live in Amesville or Logan, it's a little bit different. You have the option to choose your provider. So that's why going into these discussions, Athens has some reservations with some ways that the COG could potentially work.
And what are some of the reservations the city has with joining right now?
One of the key sticking points that Director Stone has said is voting on the board. So the COG board is made up of members, the Solid Waste District, Amesville, Logan, Athens, and Nelsonville, if they all join, and AHRC would be on the board as well. But if they all join, they would all have a say in what rates are for the COG. And something that the city administration has said that they would like to see in the bylaws is that if you are using more of the COG service, you have more of a say in what those rates are. For an example, like I said before, Athens is a franchise district. That means everyone in Athens has to use the COG if they switch to it. So that's a very large amount of people who would only have one vote in what their rates are. But what the administration wants is, even though Athens only has one vote, their vote means more than someone who doesn't only use the COG services. So it gives Athens more of a say because they are using more of the cog and are paying more for its service. Now, there has been some pushback on that from one member in particular, according to Andy Stone. So that's kind of where the city's stuck in limbo, kind of wanting to figure that out before they can even put this before council.
So how have local residents felt about this process?
So last night's meeting and last week's meeting even have been packed with people showing up and really trying to push the city to join this council of governments. As we kind of talked about, this would help save around 50 jobs, just under 50 jobs at AHRC. And a lot of people have said recycling is the next big industry and that Ohio and that Southeast Ohio should really take advantage of that. And also a number of other citizens have also sounded off saying that Rumpke is this corporate company. It's a large company. It's not local. And that's not something that some residents value. They believe that the city should be valuing small and local business and keeping our recycling local. Now, on the other hand, some other residents have reached out to council members and say that they enjoy the service from Rumpke. Councilmember Alan Swank tells me that he got an email the other day saying that there's a professionalism with Rumpke that AHRC does not have and has not had during their service in Athens. So there has been people kind of on both sides, but if you watch council, it's kind of a little bit more one-sided. And Councilmember Alan Swank said that maybe because people are too, not necessarily completely afraid, but would you go in a room full of people that don't agree with you and speak and maybe get booed is kind of how he put it. So it's very much one-sided in council, according to some of the council members. And in emails, it's a different story. So the city is kind of putting this, some support, some don't.
And then what other updates can we see about the cog in the coming months?
So the potential members are expected to meet again on April 16th. It's scheduled, but it is not set in stone just yet. And Director Stone says once the reservations have been kind of squared away and they come to a consensus, the resolution can come to council at any moment. Council really doesn't make the decision on joining the cog. The city's law department has said that this is an administrative decision. The council just has to sign off on it, basically. So the council would have to approve a resolution agreeing to join and then pass another piece of legislation officially giving Director Stone the ability to sign in, to like sign off on joining. And this all needs to happen before July. That is because a new financial report from AHRC says that come July, they're going to be out of money. And that really puts an end to this cog, because the city would have to absorb, would need to absorb AHRC's assets. And without AHRC, it's going to be very costly to do this cog, because trash trucks are not cheap. Hiring new workers is not cheap. So it's very much time is of the essence. And the city also feels very rushed, but they don't want to rush into things. They want to get this right, according to Mayor Patterson, is what he said last night.
The past three segments were done by our WOUB reporters. You can find more about these stories on WOUB's website at woub.org. That's all we have for you this week. Thanks for listening to The Outlet's 2024 special report. The Outlet is produced each week by me, Caleb McCleskey. We're edited by Teach Baidia, Aaron Payne, and David Forster. Adam Rich is our technical assistant, and our theme music is performed by Ryan Gabos. Enjoy our show? Tell a friend to give us a listen. They can subscribe to The Outlet on SoundCloud or Spotify, as well as Apple Podcasts, or find us online at woub.org. They can also follow us on Twitter at @outlet_woub and Instagram at @newswatch_woub. We'll be back next week with more stories from Southeast Ohio.